Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 283, I have the pleasure of reviewing the March 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. This edition focuses on pediatric retina and is found online at retinalphysician.com. All articles are available there for free consumption. I am joined by three people familiar with pediatric retina and uveitis to discuss these four topics, including ethics of pediatric retina situations, approaching clinical trials as a pediatric retina specialist, the role of anti-VEGF in treating retinopathy and prematurity, and common uveitic conditions and approaches for pediatric patients. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description for all participants. You can also find a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back to preview the March 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. Joining us are three physicians with experience relevant to these articles with focus on pediatric retinal disease. First, in alphabetical order from Washington, D.C., Dr. Brian Doe. Brian, welcome back.
Jay, it's an honor and a pleasure to be back with you good folks here.
Next, in her first appearance on the program from Chicago, Dr. Safa Rahmani. Safa, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And last but not least, the best triple acronym in retina, triple alliterative name, Yoshihiro Y. Yonakoa. Yoshi,
welcome. Thanks, Jay. It's an honor to be back. And we're talking about my favorite topic today.
Quick question. What does the middle Y stand for?
I think you made up that middle Y.
Oh, okay. I just call you. I've always assumed it was triple Y. You just never corrected me. I just called you triple Y and you just rolled with it.
Sounds kind of cool. I went with it.
All right. So as always, these articles are found online at retinalphysician.com. We are not going to journal club these articles. We're just going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. We're going to start with a juicy one, which is ethical considerations in the care of pediatric retina patients. The subtitle guidelines protect patients as well as the physician-patient relationship. Tala Al-Khaled, Mara Burke, and R.V. Paul Chan wrote this article. And basically, just to run through, they go through several cases where ethics can come up in the pediatric setting. For example, a case of leukocoria where the parent doesn't want to do any sort of treatment in the case of retinoblastoma causing leukocoria. And then obviously there's mortality, not just loss of eye, but potential mortality associated with this, and kind of discussing what those implications are. And maybe this article works better if we kind of go case by case. So the Kaver's case is talking about when you do have a child who needs treatment to either save an eye, save vision, or save a life, how do you kind of handle the scenario where the legal guardian slash parent refuses treatment? So Yoshi, what are your thoughts on this issue and kind of best practices to face these scenarios?
Yeah, so the authors did a great job talking about these different cases. And the first one is about parents who refuse treatment of retinoblastoma. It sounds really crazy, but we do encounter such scenarios in pediatric retina. And I think that, you know, our goal as physicians, we have to advocate for the vulnerable patient in front of us. And like the authors mentioned, I think we have to educate the family why this is important. We have to address all their concerns, communicate well, and have to try to speak in a lay terminology, I think. And if you have to, like we sometimes do, escalate it to a legal court. You know, like retinoblastoma, it's one of the things that will kill you if you don't do something about it. So you have a strong case. I don't do RB, but take care of a lot of kids. And parents are really busy, you know. Parents are young, they're working hard, oftentimes both working. Kids have school and siblings potentially with medical issues. And I have four kids and a puppy these days, and life is really crazy. So I can totally see how you could slip up and not realizing that you're doing something harmful. And so it's our responsibility to educate the parents.
Yeah, those are great points. And I mean, we see this all the time in adults. In fact, I was talking to some students today about this very issue, that part of our job as retina specialists is sometimes to have those difficult conversations. You know, for example, someone has a retinal detachment that's progressing and they don't want surgery, or they want to wait a week because they have things going on. You have to be the person to say, look, you can do that, but you're putting yourself at risk of permanent vision loss. Now, this is a case, like you said, it sounds crazy, but it's not that unique. I think that if you go to a parent with RB and say you need to enucleate this eye, many different parents and parents of different cultures will have a lot of resistance to the idea of removing an eye. It's obviously a big step to take. Safa, you practice actually in Chicago, which is where the authors of this paper came from, and maybe they're citing from example. I mean, kind of your thoughts. They brought up the idea that in a worst case scenario, that maybe the physician has an obligation to go to an ethics council or take this up to court even to get the child treated. What are your kind of thoughts, and have you seen any similar type of cases where this has come up?
Yes, the authors bring up great points in this case. And I think what I've noticed with my patients who've had resistance when I thought it was more obvious in terms of treatment was miscommunication and really the parents not understanding the level of severity or really what was going on. I find that a lot of times once the miscommunication and is sort of addressed when with the parents, they do much better, and they have a better understanding of why we're offering the treatments that we are, even if it may seem clear cut to us. I have quite a bit of experience, unfortunately, in this case. One I have now in the hospital that is actually multiple services are involved, and I'm the main person really pushing for this kiddo. This kid is an autistic child who already blinded himself in one eye, and I operated on the other eye. And he, even though he wears a helmet, he's in assisted living, so nobody's really watching him all the time. So he ends up keeps re-detaching his eye. And I've taken extraordinary measures in terms of trying to keep him in the hospital after the surgery, actually keeping him intubated. And because his self-interest really behavior is continuing, we've actually involved psych to try to change his medications and even potentially do ECT to try to help his self-interest behavior. And we had to involve our ethics committee in the hospital to really stand up for this child, because ECT is really hard to come by at Illinois, and we had to get special court clearance. Is this an appropriate avenue? And obviously, getting ECT is completely out of my wheelhouse, but what I could do was really explain to the other team members the calamity that he's able to do. Like he hits himself so hard that he breaks hockey helmets. So to break a hockey helmet, that is quite a bit of force. So there's got to be a different way to help these children. And even if there isn't, at least we have to try. So we've actually had to get emergency court orders to be able to help him. And these things come up often, unfortunately. So that's been some of my experiences. But I find in the rare case that ethics needs to get involved, it can be very helpful, especially with emergency court orders.
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, that's a very serious scenario. It reflects my Miami upbringing that when you said hockey helmet, I didn't react, but I'm on Zoom and both Yoshi and Brian are from the Northeast, both flinched, because I think they both know it takes that much force and that's the amount of force yes. into the retina right now. So let's kind of jump in, because they talk about other ethical scenarios. The second one they do is talk about clinical trials, and we're going to kind of skip that one because we have a whole article about that we can reference and get into the discussion. But they get into this discussion, Brian, about, this. What about testing kids or young teenagers who are approaching adulthood who are technically not, they're still minors, but the idea of genetic testing, right? And it's really interesting because they talk about the difference between clinical utility and personal utility. I've never heard those terms, but I think we've all talked about this concept of, does your genetic test actually change something, or does it assist with medical decision-making? Or is it just something that's going to give you information, right? So those are kind of two different concepts. So what do you think about this, right? So like you may encounter this with your uveitis patients, usually it's useful tests, but this concept of like, if it isn't going to be used for treatment, and that's what the American Society of Human Genetics is saying, that adolescents, I didn't know this, they should be included in the discussion undergoing testing if it's a genetic disease that it's for more personal utility rather than clinical utility. Have you ever heard of this distinction? And what are your kind of thoughts and reactions to that?
I haven't heard of the distinction between clinical and personal utility. I might be a little bit biased as far as genetic testing goes. We have access, fairly easy access to the NIH and NEI and their inherited retinal disease division. So, I do a fair amount of, sort of in-office genetic testing. And if something comes back that's of interest, I have a low threshold for getting patients up to Bethesda, just if anything, so that, you know, the folks up there are aware of the patient, and, you know, if at some point something becomes available in terms of clinical trials, then at least, you know, the patient has the potential to be contacted. You know, I can understand the argument for, you know, not wanting to perform genetic testing in a setting in which, you know, the practitioner may not be prepared to perform any type of intervention, or if there's no treatment available, which is largely the case for most of the diseases that we're testing for. But I try to think about it, you know, as if I were a parent, which I'm not. But, you know, I'd think that if my kid had something that were potentially going to be passed on to future generations, that, you know, I'd want to know, and I'd want my kid to know, you know, to help with family planning and things like that. You know, whether or not it's going to affect, you know, immediate medical care or short-term visual outcomes, that's not necessarily what I'm thinking about when I'm ordering this testing. And I haven't encountered that situation with kids, just because I don't see kids with retinal issues. I do take care of pediatric uveitis patients, but testing for, you know, for patients with uveitis is a little bit different, because it can significantly affect the treatment algorithm.
Seth, what about your thoughts on this idea of genetic testing in children? Again, and again, this is my own ignorance, so it's always good to learn something. I did not realize that there was the recommendation that adolescents be included, but the distinction is they should be included when it's not related to clinical utility. Meaning, again, it's more just, as Brian was said, a test that maybe gives you information for the future or for future generations or sort of planning, but it's not changing your own disease course. Any thoughts or experiences on genetic testing in this population?
Yes. I take care of the hereditary retinal disease children and adults, sort of the whole spectrum. So when they come to me early on, I do have this conversation with family that I really spin it in a way that they understand why we're getting it, which is if there's a clinical trial that the child could benefit from, we do need to know the genetic mutation of what they have. Also, with certain genetic mutations, you can give a little bit of a more clinical sort of diagnosis in terms of the prognosis of how fast the disease may progress, how slow. Those can be very helpful to family when they're planning, you know, for schooling and planning for future. You know, I have kids who have RP that will, you know, probably won't even start to drive. And I have others who have such mild cases that they'll probably be able to drive for a while and then they'll have to change. So I have all those discussions with the family as to why I'm ordering it, because it can help me give them a little bit of better idea in terms of prognosis. And then again, I can't stress to them enough that if I don't know the genetic diagnosis, if there happens to be a clinical trial that they could qualify for, I would need to know that, and that's helpful information. I still have parents that do refuse. I do have teenagers who don't want to. And once they're above 12 or 13, I do include, if the child wants to be included, sometimes the teenagers sit there and just play. But if they want to be included, I do include them. And I do make, you know, basically I'm sitting there talking to the teenager rather than the family, but I include everybody in the discussion. And I have them that they just don't want to know. And I will leave it. And I'll come back, you know, a year later, and we'll have these discussions, and sometimes they change their mind, sometimes they don't. The interesting thing is the reverse in adults. I have a lot of adults that come in and say, well, I'm okay, I'm in my 50s. I don't want to know, like, who cares if I know or not? And I say, well, do you have children? I'm like, yes, I do. Do you have grandchildren? Yes, I do. I was like, well, it could make a difference for them if you know your genetic mutation and they end up having something. So they will do the genetic testing for their family, actually. So I've had the reverse in the adult world. But the chance of them saying no is becoming less and less. And I have more and more, yeah, you know what, let's find out. Because I think the stigma of knowing your genetic mutation and, you know, the conspiracy theories behind it, which was probably 10 years or 20 years ago, a lot of it is really sort of out in the open now. We know that's not really the case, and people are more willing to be involved.
Yoshi, you know, I saw you nodding at that last comment. Anything to add? And I guess the last thing to tie this in a bow before we move on to another subject is, I mean, what do you do in the circumstance? Alpha kind of references where you have a child and an adult who disagree. It kind of ties back to our first case, but usually the retinoblastoma baby can't advocate for themselves. But if you have an adolescent who wants to get tested or doesn't want to get tested, the parent feels differently. How do you kind of manage that, Yoshi?
That's going to be a discussion in the family. You know, I leave it to them. I give them all the facts. I do like to involve teenagers in all decision-making usually. So if you have a teen in front of you, I'm usually talking to the teenager. And then I turn to the parents afterwards. Do you have any other questions? And I document in my notes, like in my informed consent forms, you know, discussed with patient and parents. And, you know, thankfully we're in the genomic era where most of our genetic testing, it does have clinical utility. It's also a lot cheaper now, and it doesn't take like a whole year to do. And so this is something that's really clinically meaningful. I was just nodding because I've known Safa for many years and she's a very convincing person. So I was just picturing her, you know, talking to the parents about the benefits of genetic testing.
So let's dive right into our next subject. I'm actually going to change up the order, not to get you guys all, you know, kerfuffled, but the second scenario they talked about was clinical trials. And we have this article that was also written called Clinical Trials in Pediatric Retinal Disease by Brittany Scruggs and J. Peter Campbell, Pete Campbell from Casey Eye Institute in Portland. And the subtitle, The Number of Potential Therapies and Growing. There's kind of two parts to this article, right? So most of this article actually focuses on going through, for example, ROP and inherited retinal disease and talking about the different trials that are ongoing or have been done. And that's useful. I think if you want to review, I think it's a good review for all of us. We don't have to go through all those. But the first part is kind of tied into the Paul Chan article. The second kind of point is, what do you do about enrolling? What are the ethics of enrolling people for pediatric retinal trials? It's a little bit different, right? Because you're consenting usually, again, a parent or guardian, and pediatric kind of trials are pretty hard to design and kind of be involved in. Yoshi, I'll let you go first and we'll sneak back. I mean, have you been involved in any pediatric retinal trials? Do you have any pearls of wisdom for somebody who wants to get involved for things that may be different in your experience than enrolling in an adult trial? Are the numbers generally lower for these trials because it's just harder to recruit? What's kind of your experience and what's the best way to kind of approach this ethically, especially as the kids get older and again, can advocate for themselves, even if they're not, you know, an adult?
Jay, I love your 10-part questions. And so I think pediatric retinal diseases and pediatric diseases, all just in general in medicine, are severely understudied for a number of good reasons. Kind of putting both of these articles together, one good perspective that I thought that was interesting is that you can't have phase one trials in kids unless there are no alternatives. And if you think about our adult studies, there are like boatloads of phase one AMD trials. And we have amazing treatments currently for AMD, but that would never fly in the pediatric world. And kids are not small adults and we can't extrapolate everything from adults, but oftentimes we have no choice and it's definitely a huge unmet need. But because of that, a lot of things that we do in children are off label. It probably will continue to be because trials are just difficult to do. There are a lot of ethical considerations in terms of getting kids enrolled. Parents are very worried about their kids being a part of trials, and they're also not, they tend not to be funded as well as adult studies, to be honest. And if you look at the best clinical trials in a pediatric retina, the best two are cryo-ROP and ET-ROP. And these are NIH-sponsored studies. These were two of the absolute best studies in probably all of ophthalmology, similar to like ETDRS and DRS. And you just don't have those kind of trials anymore. And the industry-sponsored ones are a lot smaller. They serve a purpose to get medications approved. For example, you have the Rainbow study for Lucentis for ROP. Regeneron's doing another study, but it's not thousands of patients like ETROP and cryo-ROP. It's powered enough that you'll find a difference. Not a very financially driven thing, you know, pediatric Right. retina, but such an important thing.
Brian, any perspectives as a uveitis specialist? You mentioned you see pediatric uveitis patients. I'm sure you may have been involved at some point in uveitis trials, you know, during your uveitis fellowship and beyond. I'm sure the number of pediatric patients who are enrolled in those trials, maybe they, again, may not have even been candidates. We get so used to like the first enrollment criteria being 18 years or older, and then you forget about this whole population. Any experiences kind of, again, enrolling or thinking about how you would kind of even start a trial? Because there are obviously uveitic conditions which are predominant in children, for example, GIA or tinea, like that we just don't really necessarily have a lot of trial data on.
So you know, the sort of hurdles in uveitis trials are a bit more complicated. Like in pediatric retina, you know, uveitis isn't a big moneymaker, and you know, industry-sponsored trials aren't quite as abundant as they are in, you know, let's say AMD, you know, diabetic retinopathy or RVO. And so, you know, trials in uveitis don't come along that frequently, especially ones that that really have potential to make an impact. You know, we're still enrolling in a trial called Lumina, looking at intravitreal sirolimus for non-infectious posterior segment uveitis. And like, you know, other trials before it, it, you know, if you're under 18, you're not eligible. You know, so I don't have any personal experience, you know, talking to parents or trying to convince parents and, you know, adolescents to be involved with these types of trials. You know, I'm not aware of anything else going on right now where, you know, we're looking specifically at pediatric uveitis, but, you know, even FDA approved treatments can be difficult enough to, you know, convince parents to sort of get on board for, you know, stuff like Humira, especially in the midst of the pandemic, doesn't always sound so appealing to parents, you know, who are concerned about, you know, negative systemic effects. And, you know, I can imagine that when it comes to putting, you know, putting their kiddos on, you know, previously unproven experimental treatments, it must be challenging at the very least.
Safa, just to kind of again tie up this topic about trials and anything additional to add on what Yoshi was saying, Brian has this, you know, different perspective coming from the uveitis perspective, but for pediatric retina trials, you know, Yoshi really did a good job explaining many of the reasons why these trials, again, just don't happen at the same amount financially, in terms of practicality, you know, any sort of ideas of best practices. So like if you did want to enroll patients, again, the conversation, like you said, it's the same kind of consent thing you have to talk about, but any additional considerations we haven't hit on?
No, I think Yoshi and Ryan sort of covered most of it. I think I would just stress, you know, the discussion a lot of times just feels more like they're high stakes. Even if we're a similar disease state, it still feels more high stake, you know? So if you're having a conversation with a child and family about Stargardt's versus, you know, a 50-year-old about Stargardt's, it's the same disease process, but it's just, the stakes are always higher. So I tend to find that I'm much more cautious about who I even think about considering for these trials and who I even broach, you know, because even in the same study, I even find myself, you know, double and triple thinking, is this really an ethically good trial for this child?
No, I think if I may, gene therapy for retinal degenerations in kids, that makes so much sense. And I feel that as we learn more, we're going to aim towards treating kids earlier and earlier, and earlier interventions probably going to lead to better outcomes. So there, I think there's makes a lot of sense to enroll patients in. And the other kind of realm that we're starting to enter in telehealth and artificial intelligence, global health, those are, you know, going to be really exciting avenues for research where it will totally make sense too. The difficult ones are the pharmaceutical interventional trials.
So, and, you know, I think that we kind of been pitching around Barry Bonds here, not to date myself as a baseball fan 20 years ago, but Brian has been so game with our pediatric retina discussion. We're going to go to their next article, which is uveitis and the pediatric population. Every once in a while, I get to throw it down the strike zone for Barry Bonds. So prevalence and presentation are in Youth and Children's, the subtitle. This is by Monique Monroe, Carl Becker, and Pooja Bhatt. So they do a nice job of kind of just going through the big uveitic conditions. I referenced GIA and tinea. They also talk about HLA-B27, post-infectious uveitis syndrome, which is a fascinating thing to read about and kind of refresh on. Then they kind of go through intermediate uveitis, including pars planitis, posterior uveitis conditions, including the white dot syndromes, and then kind of your pan uveitis, your big ones that you see in adults but can see in kids like VKH and sarcoid and Behçet's. And then they go through all the infectious causes. So this is actually a really great review article. And they even end with masquerades, including retinoblastoma, which
is always got to be in the differential for any child, even as the child gets older. I think we've all heard stories of kids, even in their teens, who may have retinoblastoma and mistaken for something else. And obviously a difficult thing to miss in terms of not just morbidity, but mortality. So Brian, you know, this is a really well-written review. I think that anyone who's listening, you should read all these, but this is one I think we should all kind of read and commit, because it's a good refresher. You know, Brian, when you take care of pediatric retina, so you get, I'm sure, a lot of referrals for uveitis, or you get second opinions or third opinions. Yoshi always loves if I had to quote Yoshi, I would pick a Yoshi quote. Yoshi's favorite quote is, children are not little adults. He always says that. And that probably applies here too. You talked a little bit about challenges in terms of Humira and, for example, or other systemic therapies. Parents obviously are sometimes more concerned. We're more concerned about our kids than we are about our own well-being. There are other concerns in terms of other agents and getting labs, for example, to follow someone who's on antimetabolites. Any kind of big pearls you've seen in terms of things that get referred that, again, are lost in terms of diagnostically, maybe something was missed, or from a treatment perspective, what are kind of the biggest challenges in this population? Especially, I feel like teenagers never want to listen to anyone. So why are they going to listen to Dr. Brian Doe?
Sometimes they don't, but in most situations, they have to listen to their parents. I think one of the biggest issues and the big problems that I see is under treatment of kids with chronic ocular inflammatory disease. You know, it doesn't seem like quite as big of a deal when you're dealing with somebody who's in their 50s or 60s, who's got, you know, chronic posterior segment uveitis, whether it's birdshot or VKH or something like that. And, you know, if you give them cataracts or, you know, cause their IOP to go up, you don't feel as badly about, you know, referring them to the cataract surgeon to have that taken care of. But when a kid goes down a path where they start to develop cataract and start to develop chronic IOP issues, you know, you worry about what that eye is going to look like 15 or 20 years down the road. I think many of us have seen, you know, previous kids who were, you know, undertreated for JIA associated chronic anterior uveitis, and, you know, who are adults and hypotenuse with poor vision and, you know, band keratopathy and things like that. And so I think about those people when I'm treating kids and coordinating with rheumatologists. In adults, I will usually prescribe and monitor my own metabolites. And in certain kids, I will as well, but I have a very low threshold for getting these kids into the hands of rheumatologists, just because I don't have experience and training in prescribing those medications in children, you know, even dosing and things like that. But I tend to be fairly aggressive with getting kids on those types of meds. And if they don't seem to be doing well on one, I'll switch things up fairly early on. Because, you know, I think about sort of longitudinally how good their vision needs to be for the rest of their lives. And, you know, because they don't know any better and they don't necessarily have any decision-making power, it's often sort of leveraging, you know, their parents and, you know, posing it as truly a potentially vision threatening situation. You know, it's unusual to encounter a clinical scenario where you've got sort of, you know, a single acute episode, you treat it, gets better, and then it stays away, right? The vast majority, especially in kids, of uveitis that I encounter is going to be chronic, is going to be bilateral, and does require long-term systemic immunosuppression. And I think, you know, the earlier we get to implement those treatments, the better those kids do.
And again, this may seem obvious to people listening, but I think it's the question we have to ask, because we didn't mention it because of the potential downsides. But what about decisions for systemic versus local therapy, right? So in adults, we often have this question, could you treat locally with a steroid injection or implant or subtenons injection? How often are you implementing those in a pediatric population? What are big reasons not to? Some of those may be familiar to the retina specialist listening.
So, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily either or. As far as, you know, local therapy versus systemic therapy, certainly, you know, from my training, I'm more bent towards systemic therapy, but I recognize that there's a utility for local injections. You know, for kids with, you know, bad pars planitis and things like that, it's not unusual for me to do, you know, subtenons, corticosteroids in conjunction with starting systemic immunosuppression. Just because, you know, when you're dealing with small kids, you may not want to have them on a long course of oral prednisone and have them deal with, you know, the potential effects associated with that. So I think there's a role, as there, you know, as is the case in adults, for both local and systemic therapy. I would say that I'm certainly a little more gun shy when it comes to subtenons, you know, steroids and intravitreal corticosteroids in kids. And I do tend to use orals and topicals more so, you know, in conjunction with starting immunosuppression.
And the cataracts and glaucoma results. And then we can tie in our pediatric specialist here because, you know, SAFA, I think in kids, for example, with Coats disease, people will use steroids, for example. How do you kind of incorporate the risks, I mean, or balance the risks of steroids in a child, knowing that this is an eye, like Brian says, you don't want this eye to fail in 5 or 10 or 15 years. You may understand that you're putting out one fire, you may be causing glaucoma or even need an earlier cataract surgery for this reason. What scenarios do you implement steroids for pediatric patients?
That's a great question. And I do help out with the uveitis patients at my hospital as well. I've sort of become the jack of all trades for pediatric retina. And I do what sort of Brian does. I tend to shy away from subtenons because a significant portion of the kids will have an IOP spike. I'd rather do a topical or oral or something that's very controlled and I can sort of take it away if needed. And I'm lucky that I have great uveitis specialists within the Northwestern system that I can sort of rely on if they need systemic immunosuppression. So I sort of usually get them over the hump and sort of pass them over to my uveitis specialists. But I really rarely use subtenons in kids. I can usually get them through the episode with topicals and oral most of the time.
Yoshi, how about for retinal vascular diseases in kids? Do you apply, when do you break that glass and open the steroid cabinet? Or do you kind of steer away from it because of the potential downsides?
Yeah, retinal vascular diseases tends to be relatively rare in kids. When I think of vascular diseases, they're more developmental, you know, tractional issues, and where steroids are not really indicated. But I gotta just say that I'm like in total awe of Brian's comments right now. And
I told you, it's Barry Bonds, but Safa is like, you know, 5-tool baseball player. She does everything. She has pediatric retina and uveitis. You're kind of superfluous here, Yoshi. I don't know if you realize this.
You're a designated
hitter over here. You wouldn't even qualify in the National League.
No.
Doesn't mean it, Yoshi. He doesn't mean it.
I am afraid of like white blood cells if it's not from an infection. I'm very fortunate to work with awesome uveitis experts also. And, you know, JP Dunn's like sitting right next to me every clinic and we work together a lot. And a lot of the surgical decision-making that I have on working on pediatric uveitis patients for their retinal surgical issues is in conjunction with JP and like whether is the eye quiet enough, what do we do with drops and, you know, the systemic treatment after, is it safe to go in now? Is it not? What do you want me to do during surgery? What should I not do? I think those conversations are really important.
I have to second that. I think it's absolutely critical, at least from a retina trained perspective, to really have a uveitis partner for a lot of these pediatric kids, because what I tend to find is that when these kids come without a uveitis specialist, they're usually undertreated. So what I tend to find is that when they get to me, they've usually been followed by optometrist or maybe an outside pediatric ophthalmologist, and they're just not well treated because they're all afraid of those, you know, the adding steroids and adding, you know, immunosuppression. So I get them over the hump and I very quickly involve my uveitis partners. I work with Debbie Goldstein at Northwestern. And you know, for all my pars planitis patients or anybody that needs surgery, I ask her, like, how aggressive do you want me to be? And I can be as aggressive as she tells me because they're the ones that really know these entities much better.
Well, to switch sports analogies, Yoshi, you're not superfluous. I was just kidding because I'm going to throw you a monster alley-oop they're going to throw down. So this last article is anti-VEGF therapy for management of retinopathy prematurity, subtitled Weigh Benefits and Risks in this Vulnerable Population. Zhao Chun Ling and Wei Chi Wu are the articles. And they essentially go through why VEGF may be important in ROP, the utility of potentially using anti-VEGF, the different medications that have been used, and some of the trials was applied to. You referenced Rainbow earlier, Yoshi, for example, for ranibizumab, below aflibercept, and bevacizumab have been studied, bevacizumab and BRAF, for example. And then the biggest question, which is, are there systemic risks, and how do you weigh that, and how do you dose this? And like, we could spend 45 minutes to an hour, maybe longer, talking about this. And often at retina meetings, there is an hour long discussion about this very subject, and people kind of draw their battle lines. So, and maybe there's going to be a generational component to this, because I think younger retina specialists in general are more comfortable with using this in lieu of laser, but maybe I'll get different answers from the two of you because you trained at different institutions. So Yoshi, take first crack. So what do you think the role of anti-VEGF and ROP should be? When is it best applied? Are there scenarios where you'll use anti-VEGF without doing laser or cryo?
Okay. So for ROP, I'm going to break it down, like benefits of laser, like pros and cons of each. And so so for laser, which is what I primarily do, and you can go either way, there's no correct answer. Benefits of laser: one, we have decades of experience. We know how the ROP regresses. It's very predictable after laser, and in our hands, very limited recurrence. The downsides: it takes longer, it hurts your neck and back. Technically, it can be challenging, especially for pediatric ophthalmologists. As retina doctors, I think we're pretty good at lasering. It requires longer anesthesia. Depending on how posterior it is, you can get visual field defects, you get more myopia. So benefits of anti-VEGF, which I don't routinely do, but many people do, and it's fine. Number one, it's easy if done correctly, but a lot of people may not be doing it correctly, and you can still have a lot of complications. Internationally, it's been a total game changer. It's some regions in the world, it's much more easier to access Avastin than having a really expensive laser. Less induced myopia. You don't get as much myopia after anti-VEGF injections, and you can have continued vascular growth to the periphery. But there are a lot of downsides too. Number one, the BEAT-ROP study didn't mention this, actually said the opposite, but you can have a lot of recurrences. And so you have to keep on screening on and on and on. And as the kids get bigger, they become more difficult to examine in clinic. And so you're trying to, you know, assess anterior zone 2, zone 3, but they're getting huge, they're fighting you. But some of these eyes, they never fully vascularize, and you could have recurrences and not know about it. So it gets really challenging. And so what do you do with the persistent avascular retina? Some of us laser it like I would, but a lot of people just ignore it. And we also don't know currently what the optimal dose is. We know that the full adult dose is too high. A lot of us do half dose. That's even too high. Studies look at lower dosing, but shows more recurrences. We also don't know which medications are best, Lucentis versus Avastin versus Eylea. And it does affect the systemic VEGF, as Weiqi nicely showed in his studies. We don't know if that results in a clinically significant issue, but you do have suppressed VEGF, for example, after Avastin for about a month. And this is when your heart, lungs, you know, brain, all these organs need VEGF to develop. And there are a couple of papers out there, all with issues with their methodology, but they show that kids treated with anti-VEGF have neurodevelopmental issues later. But these were all really poor studies. I don't think it's really difficult to study this. So there's good evidence for both. And I think the physician, whatever they feel comfortable with, is fine, but you just need to document the informed consent really well. And for me personally, I only have three indications when I do injections. One is very posterior disease, where you'll be lasering into the macula. If the kid's too sick for prolonged anesthesia, or if you have too much vitreous hemorrhage in the eye, where it's too much to laser, but not so much that you can't tell that there's not an RD. So if there's an RD, that's an indication of vitrectomy. And so that's kind of my spiel about anti-VEGF and ROP.
I love it. You know, Safa, we're getting close to the end, but I wanted you to weigh in as well, because you may have similar opinions or different opinions. Anything to kind of add or counterpoint to what Yoshi just said?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I'm at the children's hospital, but I'm also at the adult hospital, and each hospital has its own NICU. So depending on which NICU I'm in, I actually may use anti-VEGF versus laser because of just what Yoshi said in terms of access. When I'm in the adult hospital, it's we have a very old laser. It's very difficult to position these kids. It's very difficult to get them sedated in a way where I can do laser. And I tend to find that I pull on the anti-VEGF card first. And then with the sort of the understanding that I tell the parents that this is not the end and that you will need laser when the kiddo is about 6 months old. If I feel that, if it's a very anterior disease, then I actually have transferred the child from the adult hospital to the children's hospital, so I could just do laser and be done with it. And then in the children's hospital, similar to Yoshi, I really use anti-VEGF for really posterior disease or really sicker kids. Otherwise, the kids do really well with laser. What I tend to find is that I get referrals from outside specialists who have the failed laser. And I tend to find, myself thinking, would this kiddo have done better with anti-VEGF because they didn't get adequate laser? A lot of times that's the issue. So I feel like as this becomes a more hot button topic, I think, some of the studies quote 60% laser effectiveness, and that's really low. Like in my hands, if laser fails, something, like I test the kiddo for, fever gene in addition to ROP because something is wrong. If you do well, timely laser, you shouldn't have a 60%. You should have, 90-95% success rate. So I feel like there's all these nuances that we don't consider because there's a variety of providers taking care of these patients. But I do agree with Yoshi. I actually follow these kids pretty closely. I've had to re-inject a couple of really sicker kids a couple of times before they were stable enough that we could do laser on them. And I basically laser all my kids that have gotten anti-VEGF at about 60 to 70 weeks, depending on how stable they are systemically. And I laser all the vascular retina that I see just so I can sleep better at night.
If you should be convinced by now that Dr. Romani is legit, but when you hear ambulance sounds in the background, then you're like, he's on a totally different level than the other three people on this call. Well, guys, I don't want to keep you guys up too late, but in the interest of being totally democratic, Brian, I don't have many other thoughts to add on top of what they said. As someone who does not do pediatric retina, do you have anything you want to add on this subject?
I mean, I don't think that there is anything of real value that I can add. I applaud both you, Yoshi, and Safa for taking on these tough cases. I remember, spending time with Tom Lee and Aaron Nagel at Children's in Los Angeles where, we ran the ROP service. And it breaks your back. It breaks your heart a little bit. And, more power to you guys. Kudos, truly.
These babies, you guys commented, these babies are not stable. They desat, they decompensate while you're doing the laser. You've got to stop. They go, this is not, for anyone who has never seen this or done this, I think it's useful at some point, even if you didn't have exposure and training, to at least see it at some point, just to see what it's like. It obviously works, but that just reflects the difficulty and kind of the talent of the people who do it, because it is definitely an art form. Not nearly the same as lasering your compliant adult in your exam room in your office. So guys, I really appreciate you guys taking the time. Brian, Safa, Yoshi, thanks so much for joining us and talking about this edition. And again, for the listeners, if you found these articles interesting, you want to read more, again, we didn't go into exhaustive detail. They're available on retinalphysician.com. Guys, have a great night and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Good night, thank you.
Thanks guys.
Thank you to our correspondents for joining us today. You can find this podcast episode and all our other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's retinapodcast.com. All 283 episodes are found there sorted by category. In addition, you can find links to subscribe and receive email updates on the latest episodes. I prefer to receive my updates via the Apple Podcast app on my iPhone. You can also use a similar app on your Android device. We are on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to reach us, you can email us directly at retinapodcast.com or click the Contact Us link on our website. Thanks again to Drs. Doe, Romani, and Yonakawa for joining us for this episode. Thank you to our stellar team, Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Venicasa, who take care of the production and social media for this and all other episodes. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of every day, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
feeling?
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.